Louisiana Eats is brought to you with support from Louisiana Fish Fry, a staple of Louisiana kitchens for nearly 40 years. Maker of batters, coatings, boils, tartar sauce, cocktail sauce, and more. Louisiana Fish Fry, because life needs Louisiana flavor. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Since ancient times, the Eastern Mediterranean has been one of the most significant regions in the world. Sitting at the crossroads of trade routes, the area, which broadly defined includes Israel, Syria, Greece, and Turkey, has long been a melting pot of cultures and culinary influences. On this week's show, we meet local restaurateurs who are showcasing the rich heritage of the region and learn about the Lebanese diaspora in Louisiana. We begin with Vasiliki Elwood Gigasis, owner of Smoke and Honey in New Orleans. The restaurant and menu draw on Vasiliki's Jewish heritage and her upbringing in Greece. Next, we speak with researcher and curator Abigail Rode Pausina. The New Orleans native has taken her cultural exploration to Lebanon and beyond, but has most recently concentrated her efforts on the Lebanese families who have called Louisiana home for generations. We also hear the story of Turkish natives Azgur and Bulant Duman, and their Mandeville restaurant, Duman Artisan Kitchen. Influenced by Turkish, Italian, Israeli, and American cooking, the Dumans have cultivated an eclectic menu, the likes of which have not been seen on the North Shore before. We're hopping from Greece to the Fertile Crescent and back to the Crescent City on this week's Louisiana Eats.
I'm Vasiliki Elwood Yagazis, and I am the owner of Smoke and Honey.
Born and raised in Greece before emigrating to America at the age of 7, Vasiliki Elwood Yagazis has spent her life eating traditional Greek food. During the pandemic, she turned her love for her native cuisine and Jewish heritage into a successful New Orleans pop-up, serving items like lamb poor boys, breakfast gyros, and matzo ball soup. Smoke and Honey popped up regularly at Coffee Science and Pal's Lounge in Mid-City. In January 2024, a brick-and-mortar location opened in a bright yellow building on Bienville Street. Vasiliki joined us in the studio to talk about the concept. She began by telling us about growing up in Greece.
Well, I have two incredible parents who are both incredible cooks. And, you know, I come from a long line of incredible cooks and people who have always had this joy around the kitchen and feeding people. And the Greeks are notoriously known for feeding you more and more and more and more. And if you say I'm full, they say, no, you're not. Just keep eating. So it's in my blood for sure.
And where in Greece? What was this childhood in Greece like?
Oh, it was so great. I was born in Athens, and then I spent my childhood in Aegina, which is one of the closest inhabited islands to Athens. So it's kind of a commuter island. And I had an incredible childhood, you know, running around outside, a lot of nature, a lot of friends, swimming in the sea, eating incredible food. I, you know, have a mother who always prioritized delicious, healthy, nutritious food. And there was no disconnect between us in the kitchen and the parents in the kitchen. So it was kind of a communal experience for all of us.
There seems to be in Greece such a close tie between the plate and the garden and the sea. And I think it's kind of been that way since the dawn of time.
Absolutely. No, I mean, I think that's why Greek cuisine specifically, and you can find it with other neighboring Mediterranean countries, is the seasonal aspect. You know, it's the way that you eat as a Greek is what's in season, what can you grow, what can you catch, what is on your farm or your land. And that is why the cuisine is so healthy and abundant. And I think what's so amazing about Greece as well is you have the mountains, and the cuisine is very different in the mountains than it is on the islands and in the sea. Everyone does their gyro a little bit differently, but overall, you're going to have French fries in your gyro, and it's going to be delicious.
That's so crazy, because I never saw French fries in my gyro until I had them at Smoke and Honey, your restaurant. Nobody does that in America. How strange that that's authentic.
It is authentic. And I think that's what I've been searching for my whole life, especially in the way that I cook and feed the people I love, is I've been trying to get back to all those foods that I had as a child. And then when my family emigrated to America, there was a huge void of the cuisine that I grew up and knew and loved, except for my mom's kitchen. So I've been trying to perfect that gyro and bring it to the people of America for, you know, 20 some years. And I think I nailed it. I think I brought it.
I think you did. So how old were you when you all emigrated to America?
I was 7. My mom and my stepdad met in Greece while he was on vacation, exchanged love letters for a couple of years, very Mamma Mia. And then he brought us over to Maryland. He's also full Greek, Greek American. And there are quite a few Greeks in Maryland. So I had this whole new Greek family. So it felt comfortable. It wasn't like I was completely shocked into an American culture. But I will say it was very difficult to acclimate. It took me many, many years after that to learn how to read and write properly and feel comfortable and, you know, safe in my skin as this new immigrant girl trying to figure out her way in America.
So where does the Jewish piece come into this?
So the Jewish piece comes in. So my mom is English, and probably about 8 years ago, we were visiting my grandfather, and he had said, I've been working on the family tree. And I said, oh, okay, cool. And he said, yeah, your grandmother's, my mom's mom's family, great, great, great grandmother, way back, said, oh, yeah, they're the Levies in England. I said, what do you mean? Yeah, you're Jewish. And I said, what? What are you talking about? We've never heard of this. And so we kind of talked about the lineage, and the Jewish culture and practice kind of stopped in like 1918, 1917, and we never really spoke about it again in the family. And it made a lot of sense to me because I have an affinity for the Jewish people. A lot of my friends are Jewish. I love the Jewish boys. It made a lot of sense for me. So I said, oh my goodness, okay. And I started taking in these recipes from all these Jewish families that I loved and cared about so much. And they were so generous with their traditional family recipes. And I kind of started immersing myself in learning how to cook Jewish cuisine. And I think what's so incredible about Jewish cuisine is that it's so different and it's so international. There is no one specific cuisine that can identify in the Jewish culture. You know, you have Ashkenazi cuisine, you have Sephardic cuisine, there's a lot of African influence, Mediterranean influence, which I just think is so incredible. And each family does their own spin on different recipes that come from their family's lineage. So I kind of incorporated that And then when I was starting this pop-up, you know, I want matzo ball soup every single day of my life.
Of course you do, because your matzo ball soup rocks, having consumed it myself now. But so, Vasilike, give me like a little thumbnail sketch, though, because I'm still very confused about how you get from Baltimore into pursuing a career in theater and wind up in New Orleans. Like, what's that about?
I have no idea. No. So after growing up in Maryland, I got my BFA in musical theater. And soon after that, I went to New York and pursued a musical theater career. And after, I think, about almost 2 years in New York City, I needed the sunshine. I was so cold all the time. And so I went to LA, and I knew that, you know, I wanted the longevity of my career in film and TV, and spent about a decade in Los Angeles. I never thought I would leave Los Angeles. And my beloved Jewish boy, who is from New Orleans originally, during the pandemic, he said, "Do you want to move to New Orleans?" And I said, "Yes." So, and that's how I got to New Orleans in 2020. My industry, the acting industry, was non-existent at the time. You know, the whole industry was shut down, and we really had no idea when it was going to start back up again. And I needed something to do. I needed something, some sort of income and outlet. And my very dear friends at Coffee Science had started the Mid-City Farmers Market. And Leah said, "Come sell your tzatziki and your matzo ball soup. Like, just set up on Sundays." And I was like, "That sounds great. Yes, let's do that." So I started Smoke and Honey, and I started selling tzatziki and matzo ball soup and marinated beets on Sundays. And then soon after that, I locked in a Pal's pop-up residency on Monday nights.
Ah. So why Smoke and Honey? What's that about?
So Smoke and Honey came from, originally it was, so it was these two worlds, right? You have got the Greek and the Jewish. And I said, how do I blend these and really like make it feel like it's authentic to me? So originally it was smoked salmon and honey. So you got the smoked salmon for the Jewish side and you got the Greek honey. And then it just kind of got tightened up. I had a girlfriend go, "Why does it just be Smoke and Honey?" I said, "That's it. It's Smoke and Honey.
You can go and get a poor boy version of a lamb sandwich and a little matzo ball soup, too."
The matzo ball soup, really traditional Greek salad, which in Greece is called the Horiatiki salata.
And I know you're doing smoked salmon.
I have an incredible, incredible chef, Lucy Winsberg, who is just, she's the fish goddess. And she, we created something called the Locksmith, which is a hot smoked salmon and capers and pickled onions on a rye bread, marbled rye. And it is just so delicious. And we do have a few items that you can only get at dinner. And that includes the lemon potatoes, which are so delicious. And they're soaked in lemon juice and olive oil and oregano and a little salt. They're just the perfect little snack. And then I've got the pasticcio, which is a very traditional Greek dish. All the Greeks will hate me for saying this, but it is like a Greek lasagna, even though the Greeks invented lasagna first, called pasticcio. And it is a spiced ground beef with a really thick layer of bechamel topped with kefalotiri, which is a nutty Greek cheese, and some water-like bucatini noodles. And it is served on our little cast iron. It's so delicious. It's so amazing. I'm craving it right now, actually.
And cocktails, too.
Right? And cocktails, yes. I've got a really great cocktail called the Skinny Dip.
And what's that?
Which is a mastika liqueur. And mastika comes from Chio, the island of Chios. It's a resin that comes off trees. And it's this most gorgeous floral, piney liqueur that I mix with lemonade and top with a little bubbly water. And it is just so refreshing and so delicious. It's like a spiked lemonade with a really yummy twist. And I was like, this is my favorite cocktail.
it blew my mind when I walked in and saw how you had transformed that little space, because it's so warm and inviting. And I am sure that when the lights go down, it's a very romantic,
it's very
charming
romantic
spot.
I really wanted to have a very, very cute, lovely, comforting date night spot where you could come and get some good food, good drinks, and just hang out and feel so loved. You know, I wanted to create an atmosphere that felt like my living room and my kitchen. And it's all open concept. I've put tile on every single wall because I'm Greek. And, you know, we love our tile. I'm really, really proud of what we created.
Well, I think you've done such a great job, and it's such a wonderful new asset for New Orleans. It's very rare that you find something that's fresh and new in a city that's over 300 years old, but I think you did it.
Oh.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Poppy. This was wonderful.
Siliki Elwood Yigasis, owner of Smoke and Honey in New Orleans Mid-City. Coming up next, we're joined by Abigail Rode Posina, who tells us about the Lebanese diaspora who have called Louisiana home for generations. Louisiana Eats returns after the break. Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Crystal Hot Sauce, always made with just three simple ingredients: aged red cayenne peppers, distilled white vinegar, and salt. Nothing artificial. Crystal Hot Sauce. Step out of the heat and into the flavor. And from Rouse's Markets, synonymous with seafood, straight from Louisiana's waterways. Rouse's Markets, tastes like home. Everyone knows about New Orleans French Quarter. You may have even heard of the Irish Channel, and the German coast. But starting in the late 19th century, Louisiana also became home to immigrants from what was then called Ottoman Syria, the region that is now Syria and Lebanon. Native New Orleanian Abigail Rode Posina can trace her family's history back to that first wave of settlers. Upon arrival, her great-great-grandparents made their way south to New Iberia before settling permanently in New Orleans, where they ran a dry goods store in the quarter. The story of Abigail's family is just one piece of her exhibit, A Syrian-Lebanese American Kitchen, which she assembled as part of her doctoral work and was recently displayed at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Abigail interviewed over a dozen participants from Syrian and Lebanese families to tell their story and explore cultural connections through food. Abby, you are just blowing my mind. This old, lifelong New Orleanian, when you reached out to me and I examined my memory, I really am not aware of the Syrian-Lebanese community in New Orleans. Would you please share with us your family's story?
Absolutely. So I'm a lifelong New Orleanian as well. I'm a fifth generation Syrian American. My great great grandparents, who were named Khalil and Emily Sliman, immigrated to the United States in 1897. And that was a big time for like a big first wave of Syrian and Lebanese immigrants to the U.S.
That's so interesting to me because at the same time they came to New Orleans. You know, what we know about and what we hear about are the Sicilians. How were the Syrian Lebanese lost in that immigration story?
Yeah, that's a really good point. There's a lot of different theories out there. In my research, I've come across some ideas that the smaller numbers contributed to it. And also, when they arrived through Ellis Island, they spread all over the country. They were peddlers. They traveled along the railroad tracks and down the rivers. And I think a lot of them were drawn to New Orleans because they either already had family members or friends here, or maybe the French connection from the colonial influence back in Syria and Lebanon that was attractive here in New Orleans. Similar climate, similar religious practices. New Orleans has always been a very Catholic city, and many of these people who came over were devout Maronite or Orthodox Christians. And so they just sort of transitioned right into the New Orleanian way of life.
Did these people then find a place in the Greek Orthodox Church?
Some did. A lot just converted straight to Roman Catholicism because there wasn't a Maronite church here. And I don't believe the Greek Orthodox Church opened here until later. So they probably practiced personally or just converted to Roman Catholicism.
Because it is prevalent.
Yes.
Now, one of the really interesting things that we discussed is the reason that their culture got kind of stashed. Why would they have hidden their heritage?
Yeah, I think there was always that tension between maintaining, in any immigrant community, maintaining your cultural heritage, but also wanting to assimilate to your new way of life. And the Syrian and Lebanese families who came here were very good at assimilating and becoming American. My grandmother, for instance, they named her Shirley. They didn't teach her to speak Arabic fluently. Her parents would speak Arabic to each other when they didn't want the kids to know what they were saying. And they really just wanted her to be American because that was the American dream that they were after. But the cultural traditions that were most important to them, and that's what I've come across in my research, the ones that did get passed down, of course, was the food and the cooking.
The kibbe,
the meshi, yes, the tabbouleh. I mean, I'm a fifth generation, like I said, and I know how to roll meshi because my mom taught me and her mom taught her and her mom had taught her all the way back to those original immigrants.
You know, incredible the far-reaching effects of Jim Crow, because these people, there was some tension over their very race.
Yes. Yeah. It's interesting when you look into the naturalization court records of when Syrian and Lebanese immigrants around the turn of the century were becoming U.S. citizens. Many of them hired lawyers so they could be legally identified by the government as white. And that is also the first time we really see that legal definition of whiteness in the United States. And it, you know, like you're mentioning, it had great tension with what was going on in the South at the time. There's many different theories about why they would have wanted to codify that into law. I mean, everyone in my family says they're white. Even my grandmother, who was 100% Syrian, her whole life said she was white. But in my own theory, I have a feeling that those people who came over, they were looking around, like you mentioned, in Jim Crow era New Orleans, and they didn't want to not be white because of how non-white people were being treated, and especially the black community. And by being legally white, they had different access and different inroads to the Southern Jim Crow era economies at that time.
The economies. So these were very successful people who started very successful businesses and made a lot of money. So tell us about these New Orleans businesses that I don't connect with this at all.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I interviewed 15 different participants who were descendants of families who came over around the turn of the century and opened up businesses in New Orleans. Many of them had dry goods stores in the French Quarter. Many of them had import businesses where they would import olive oil, spices, linens, other dry goods. And a lot of them, like I mentioned before, started off as peddlers and worked and worked and worked until they could save up enough money to have their own storefront. Another hallmark of the Syrian Lebanese American experience in business. Every member of the family would have been involved in working at the stores. The women were like hard workers and would work in their family businesses and the front counters. And other than that, they would be in the kitchen rolling meshi with all of their sisters and cousins and aunts. It was always a very communal activity. But yeah, as far as the businesses, many of them are still around today in different forms. We have Kelly and Abide. They're Lebanese, Syrian Lebanese. We have the Solomons. We have the Abouds. There was an Aboud grocery store in the French Quarter. My great-great-grandparents had the Sliman grocery store. We also had businesses in New Iberia. So you see a lot of like merchants. You see a lot of selling and importing.
When did you realize that you had such a special story? So you went to Notre Dame and studied Arabic language. Very interesting. How did the FBI or the CIA not come and recruit you?
It's interesting you say that because I did get some calls after after I got back to New Orleans, mostly from oil companies. But yeah, people always assume that I must want to go into some kind of intelligence or counterintelligence. But for me, it was just a way to connect with my roots because we had to do a language at Notre Dame. And I had done a lot of Spanish in my high school. And I just thought I'd give Arabic a try. And I honestly just fell in love with the language and felt in that way very connected to my heritage, which, you know, being a fifth generation, I often feel quite distant and removed from.
So you go and live in Jordan.
I did.
Tell me about that.
Oh, it was crazy. I mean, I went first to study abroad for 4 months with my, you know, with a program of kids. I was the only person who went from my school, but that was amazing. I lived with a host family. I got to attend classes at an amazing university in Amman, Princess Sumaya University of Technology. But then more recently, after I finished my master's, I moved back out there with a couple friends for about a year. And we just lived and worked and tried to speak Arabic and met people, and yeah, it was amazing. While I can't really travel to Syria right now and, you know, connect with my roots in that way, it did help me feel very close.
I loved the fact that while you were doing that, you discovered an organization that preserves Syrian heritage and cooking.
Yeah.
What a guidepost to the work you're trying to do. Tell me about that organization.
Yeah, they were a huge, huge inspiration to me. I tried to work with them as much as I could. Their organization is called Beit City. They have a website where you can order their olive oil and their spices that are all made by Jordanian women.
What does that name mean?
So Beit City, it just means grandmother's house.
Oh.
In Arabic, yeah. And it's, you know, it's very connected to me because I called my grandmother Siti and she recently passed away. So yeah, I got to go to grandmother's house for work every day. But I help them out with a little bit of their digital sphere. But what they mainly do to help preserve the Syrian cultural traditions is offer cooking classes with these amazing women who just absolutely throw down delicious Syrian and Lebanese recipes. And I learned a lot of Arabic from them, lots of, you know, kitchen Arabic. So it was an amazing experience. I wish I could still be there working with them.
How terrific you got to come home. And of course, the Southern Food and Beverage Museum is here, which, of course, is a perfect platform for your work. Tell me about the exhibit experience.
Yes, so it's called A Syrian Lebanese American Kitchen. What I attempted to do with creating the exhibit is to try to capture what a typical Syrian Lebanese American kitchen would have looked like around the turn of the century, trying to pull in artifacts dating back to that time. We have an antique stove. We have an antique ice box. I have my great-great-grandparents' meat grinder, which is how they would grind the lamb to make the meshi and the kubbe. kippe, the kibbe, and lots of other amazing artifacts. And then also just it's a great backdrop to display all of the information that I've gathered through my interviews with all of the different descendants of those early immigrants, information about language death and religious change and immigration experiences through Ellis Island. And yeah, I mean, all the people I spoke to still have grapevines in their backyard. So you'll see a grapevine collage in the exhibit as well, because everyone, you know, they still roll their own meshi from their own grapevine. And some people's grapevines they shared with me are even dating back to Syria and Lebanon, that cuttings were brought over around the turn of the century, that is still the roots of the vines that they have in their backyards to this day.
What a rich and delicious story you uncovered. And at the base of all of this effort and all of this work, what do you hope will grow out of it?
That's a great question. I know the reasons that I did it, and it was to try to feel more connected to my family and my heritage, and especially my city, my grandmother, who recently passed away. She would have absolutely loved this exhibit. But I hope that other people come and realize that, like you've mentioned yourself, that the Syrian Lebanese people have been in New Orleans and have been working hard and influencing Creole cuisine and the New Orleans economy for a long time now. And we're here to stay, and we're here to share our delicious recipes and our delicious food with anyone and everyone. And I hope that other people can be inspired to sort of hold on to their own heritage in that way and pass down what's important to them to their descendants.
Abby, I can only imagine how proud your city is of the amazing work you've done. I wish she could be at the exhibit too.
I keep saying that to my mom as you know, when I was back working on it, and she was saying, you know, she is there, and she especially is there because I have dedicated this exhibit to her, and there is a display honoring her memory, showing pictures of her rolling meshi and displaying her cookbook as well. So she's absolutely involved in everything I do in my life, but especially this.
Thank you so much for your amazing work and for sharing it with all my Louisiana Eats listeners.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. It's been awesome.
That was curator and researcher Abigail Rode Posina. Her exhibit, A Syrian Lebanese American Kitchen, assembled as part of her doctoral work, was recently displayed at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. She currently lives in London, where she continues to pursue her culinary roots. Is Lebanese iced tea, and where does it come from? Stay tuned, and we'll fill you in on the origin of this refreshing beverage when we come right back. Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Blue Plate Mayonnaise, the beloved secret ingredient of Louisiana kitchens for over 90 years. Made with just oil, vinegar, and only the egg yolks. Now Blue Plate is dressing up seafood feasts with a new creamy cocktail sauce. Enhanced with bold horseradish and a secret blend of spices, you just dip, savor, and say, ah. And for a touch of Creole charm, Blue Plate's Creole tartar sauce, complete with pickles, aromatic herbs, and a touch of Creole mustard, all together in that classic mayo base. Blue Plate mayonnaise. That's the good stuff. And from Louisiana Fish Fry, now doing for chicken what they've always done for fish. Fried chicken tenders, wings, sandwiches, and more. Louisiana Fish Fry has you covered with a mix specially for chicken. Louisiana Fish Fry, because life needs Louisiana flavor. And from Visit the North Shore, discover world-class culinary flavors on the North Shore this summer. Experience the bounty of the bayou and rich culture from award-winning chefs, soulful mom-and-pop restaurants, extraordinary bakers, and creative mixologists. To learn more, request the Explore the North Shore Visitor Guide for inspirational stories, custom itineraries, and event information at visitthenorthshore.com. St. Tammany Parish, Louisiana's easy escape. Just 40 minutes from New Orleans French Quarter. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen. What is Lebanese iced tea, and where does it come from? Composed of sweetened black tea, a splash of rose water, lemon, and a spoonful of pine nuts, this aromatic iced beverage makes for a welcome addition to any hot summer day. Light and refreshing, Lebanese iced tea also provides a perfect complement to the bright herbs and spices commonly used in Middle Eastern cuisine. But don't go looking for it in Lebanon. This drink has the distinction of being invented right here in New Orleans. Nick Monum and Karim Taha are the brothers-in-law behind Mona's Cafe, a successful Middle Eastern restaurant and grocery store that started as a mid-city pita bakery in 1987. When Mona's expanded to become a restaurant in the early 90s, Nick and Karim created a new drink for the menu, one inspired by jalab, a beloved summertime drink in Lebanon. While their Lebanese iced tea shares jalap's color, flower water, and pine nut garnish, the recipe is uniquely New Orleans, with its base of iced tea firmly rooted in Southern culture. In the decades since Nick and Karim's invention was first served, it's become such a hit that Middle Eastern restaurants throughout Louisiana offer their own take on Mona's Lebanese iced tea. And its popularity has been growing across state lines, too. You'll find the drink on menus in Texas and, more recently, Alabama and Mississippi. Who knows where it'll pop up next? I'm Poppy Tooker, and Mona's Lebanese iced tea is real Louisiana tea.
My name is Özgür Duman. I am the co-owner and co-chef at Duman's Artisan Kitchen, together with my husband, Bülent Duman.
Just south of Highway 190 in Mandeville, only about 45 minutes from downtown New Orleans, you'll come across Duman Artisan Kitchen, a husband and wife collaboration producing some extraordinary fare in a beautiful setting. Influenced by Turkish, Italian, Israeli, and American cooking, Özgür and Bülent Duman offer an eclectic menu unusual for the North Shore. Louisiana Eats had the opportunity to sit down with Özgür and reflect on how the Turkish immigrants came to open Duman's Artisan Kitchen.
Where are you all from originally, and how do you happen to be here on the North Shore with this business?
We are from Istanbul, which is a huge melting pot of different cultures, different religions and backgrounds of people. They are all there. And we have an enormous cuisine in Turkey, specifically in Istanbul, because all the East and West come together in a place like Istanbul. And even though we both are Turkish, my mom was married to an Israeli man, and we have been together with some Jewish communities all throughout my life. And I was born in Germany. My mom's side comes from Greece, partially from Bulgaria. So we have a lot going on as far as cultures and cuisine, and I am very happy of it. We are very blessed, honestly.
Now, of all of the places in the United States where you could choose to live, how did you all end up settling here?
It was a series of misfortunate events and coincidences. It is a really, really long story, but I am not gonna lie, when I first ended up in Louisiana, I did not like it one bit. It was the middle of the summer. It was so hot and all the bugs and everything, but after a while, it grows on you, and we fell in love, and we didn't even think of moving anywhere else after that. This, what we have here, was the dream all along. So when we found this building here, we actually discovered Mandeville, and we fell in love with Mandeville as well. The people are amazing here. They are very kind and friendly and accepting. And it was probably the best decision of our lives to come to Mandeville with this business.
And how long ago was it that you came to the United States? So how long have you been at this restaurant game?
Well, we have been in the States for a little over 10 years. And ever since then, we have been in pizza business one way or another. So all this is a accumulation of all the experience of doing pizza for 10 years.
Why pizza? I think that is so fascinating because I think it's fairly common somehow for people to come to the United States and all different nationalities often end up with pizza. What is it? How did that happen?
Well, the thing is, people know pizza as a strictly Italian food, which is not really the case. Pretty much everywhere in the European region, they have their own kind of pizza. We have pide in Turkey. It's exactly the same thing as a pizza. It's just not round. It's kind of like a football shape. Even though pizza is famous of being Italian, Turkey is also, like, among ourselves, we are known for our pide, so it's not a unfamiliar product for our cuisine. Did I ever think that I would end up having a pizza place? Honestly, no. We both come from backgrounds of being professional office people. I did cook all my life, my husband did cook all his life, but we did not do it professionally before. We, again, just by some series of coincidences, we found ourselves working with a friend in a pizza business, and we just fell in love with it. We loved what we're doing, and we tried to better it, perfect it. Honestly, when we first opened this place, with our new oven, we had to adjust our recipe, and when we hit this recipe that we have right now, I cried. When we made our first pizza, I was like, yes, this is what I have been dreaming for. This is what we were trying to do.
So I know pizza is a large part of your business, but there's so much more because I read your menu and there's all sorts of delicious things, everything from Italian classics to gyros and hummus.
Yes, well, our background is Turkish, so we are trying to incorporate some of our cultural food in what we are doing. Also with the Italian classics like the lasagna, It is a Italian classic, but the lasagna that we're making here is actually my mom's recipe, who is Turkish. So our meatballs, that's why we have the arugulas and the hummus. The hummus is also my mom's ex-husband's recipe. It's a family recipe from Israel. So it is Italian and pizza, but we try to put a little bit of a spin to it, incorporating our heritage as well.
You know, anybody would say, oh, the life of a small restaurant owner.
Oh, don't get me started.
Well, I'd like to know, what's life like for you and your husband?
Well, I tell this to everybody who would listen, friends and everybody who is jealous of the thing that we have here. People say, oh, I want to have a small cafe, I want to open a restaurant. What I tell them is, if you are not absolutely in love and passionate about what you are doing, then don't. Because this is not a sane person thing to do. I'm not kidding. It is long hours, hard work, like physical labor. There is a saying in the restaurant industry, what do you call a chef's wife? You call her an ex. Because, we are very fortunate to be doing this together. You have no special days, no New Year's, no Valentine's Day, no Mother's Day, no nothing. You are always working. So it is hard. We are closed on Mondays and Tuesdays. Nothing is happening on Mondays and Tuesdays. So you have a very rough social life. You're working on the weekends where all the festivals are happening, the concerts, the sports events. You're working. But we love what we're doing, so it is worth every second of it, every tear, sweat, and blood that goes into it.
That was Ozgur Duman, co-owner and co-chef of Duman Artisan Kitchen. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Catch up on previous editions of Louisiana Eats on poppytooker.com, where over a decade of Louisiana Eats is available for pod and webcasting, along with recipes and cooking class videos, too. And don't forget to rate us on your preferred podcast platform. Major support for Louisiana Eats comes from Blue Plate Mayonnaise. When your poor boys, potato salads, and remoulade need that authentic New Orleans flavor, Blue Plate Mayo, that's the good stuff. And from the Audubon Clubhouse, from Dickie Brennan and Company. Situated in Audubon Park, just off Magazine Street, the newly renovated and expanded property adds a bar and private dining space to the expansive wraparound porch and dining room. Serving lunch Monday through Friday, weekend brunch, and now dinner Monday through Thursday till 9 p.m. Louisiana Eats is also made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Louisiana Fish Fry, Crystal Hot Sauce, Rouse's Markets, Visit the North Shore, and Camellia Beans. Camellia's new red beans for two and white beans for two include everything needed to cook two authentically seasoned bowls of beans scaled for today's smaller households. Learn more at CamelliaBrand.com. And from D'Agostino Pasta, celebrating our culture with fleur-de-lis, crawfish, and alligator-shaped pastas. All handcrafted in Louisiana, just as it's been done in Sicily for centuries. Visit D'AgostinoPasta.com to learn more.
original theme music composed by David Pomerleau and performed by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to senior producer Joe Schreiner, producers Blake Longlinet and Steve Himmelfarb, with writing contributions from Becky Retz, and to our business manager and social media maven, Maddie Mulladew. Catch up with us anytime on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, too. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.